Entrepreneur is one of those words that can be applied pretty broadly, but it still doesn't seem to wrap up Troy Carter. Carter is one of the biggest names in talent management. He is most famous for helping to break Lady Gaga. He's also ushered in the likes of Eve, Meghan Trainor, and John Legend, to name just a couple. Over the past decade or so, Carter has become a master at using tech and social media to turn raw talent into refined stars. And 5 years ago, he founded the talent management agency Atom Factory. Carter, though, is becoming more notable for his presence in Silicon Valley. In 2011, he launched his own startup. It's called The Backplane, that teams celebrities with brands on Twitter and Facebook. Also, he was an early investor in a slew of successful startups like Uber, Spotify, Warby Parker, and Dropbox, to name just a couple. He's now helping to seed the next generation of startups with a new venture capital firm called AF Square. And I talked to him in New York City recently, live on stage as part of the Fast Company Innovation Festival. And we figured that chat would be perfect for Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
I want to start with a little bit of biography from you. You're a guy from West Philadelphia. You hooked into the music scene with Will Smith and DJ Jazzy Jeff and Notorious B.I.G. and those guys. How much of what you are today, which is a leading tech entrepreneur, a music impresario, how much of it comes from where you come from?
I think it all comes from there. You know, I think it's more hustle than anything else. You know, I grew up West Philadelphia, born and raised. And but I grew up carrying crates of records for Will Smith and those guys. I thought I was going to be a rapper as a kid and used to hop the train down to Jazzy Jeff's studio for like 6 months straight, waiting outside of the studio for the big break. And one day we got in the studio and played our demo for Will and Jeff, and quickly learned that we weren't that good. but they, Will and his partner James Lasseter kind of saw some potential in our hustle and kind of took me under their wing. But I kind of went to LA when Will did Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, yep. Came back to the East Coast and worked for P. Diddy when he was starting Bad Boy Entertainment.
Yep.
And you know, I was a concert promoter and met him through promoting shows. And Puff said, he was like one of the first young entrepreneurs that I met, and he was kind of commanding the room.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, I want to come work for you. And he said, well, your first job is to get me that girl from behind the bar. And I got him the girl from behind the bar, and then I started working for Puff. But what was good was I got a chance to really experience entrepreneurship,
mm-hmm.
and kind of working for Will, it was 30,000 feet. Working for Puffy, it was like this sort of hand-to-hand combat. But my mom worked at Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia for 30 years. And she got up at 5:30 a.m. every single morning. I don't recall her ever taking a sick day. You know, it's like literally would get up every single day. And I think that instilled this sort of work ethic.
There's a great line from her. She threatened to, if she saw you on the street corners of Philadelphia, she was going to go hang there with you. And
yes.
She said, you don't want your mom hanging on the street corners of Philadelphia with you, right?
Exactly.
You're a guy who's virtually every article about you, somewhere in the first paragraph says, he's the guy who made Lady Gaga. Who discovered Lady Gaga and turned her into what she has become. Does that make you crazy?
No, I think that's an overstatement, by the way. It's
like, well, that's what the article said, man. I mean, whether or not you made Lady Gaga.
Don't believe everything you on the internet, unless it's TMZ. They get the real scoop. I think it's overstated. You know, you can't make an artist like Lady Gaga. You know, you can help develop, you can help support the vision. I think you can add to the vision, mm-hmm. but in terms of making an artist like that, you just can't make it. That's like saying, you know, LeBron James's high school coach made LeBron James. You know, LeBron mm-hmm. James made LeBron James. You know, just from the time he's able to put into the gym, and I feel the same thing about her, yeah.
What's your skill then? Is your skill finding talent and identifying it? Or is your skill taking talent and growing it?
I think my skill set is I think I really understand people, and I think I'm a really good problem solver. You know, and I kind of look for how do I fix this puzzle? Like, I'm the geek who I read Harvard case studies for fun.
Wow.
Yeah, like
you have got to get out more, man.
Yeah, I know. But I like to learn how to figure out and solve puzzles. So when young artists come to us, my job is to figure out, okay, this person's talented. Like I recognize talent, of course, and I think I probably have a better ability than a layman to recognize talent. But I wouldn't say that I can hear a good record and make a good record great. There's only a few people that can do that, right?
Right.
But you partner with people who know how to make records great, and my job is to be able to take that and get it to the promised land.
Did people know what you were doing? And I don't want to stay on Gaga for too long, but you did some really creative and innovative things when you broke her, right? Social media and all of that.
We didn't know what we were doing.
That was the question.
So it's not even a question of whether people knew what we were doing. We didn't know what we were doing.
You were just making it up as you went along.
Yes. So what happened was, I think we had a lot of experience in urban music, you know, so, and in hip hop, we really knew how to develop acts, and it was a certain pattern that you would use to develop and break acts, right?
Right.
You would do 3 or 4 shows a night. You would, you would have a street team in place that would go out and pass out flyers. And we literally took that same strategy and broke Gaga with that same exact strategy. You know, it just so happened that radio wouldn't play the music.
Yeah.
And, you know, they basically told us it was dance music. It was like this 4-on-the-floor dance music. And at that time, Facebook was just coming out of .edu, YouTube was just rising, Twitter was just rising, and we were able to kind of catch this cultural wave and this sort of artistic democracy. And also, you saw the shift from like Rolling Stone kind of controlling the review process and to Perez Hilton,
right,
you know, all of a sudden being like the music influencer. And he became more important to us than, like, even getting a Rolling Stone cover at that point.
So technology enabled a lot of what you did, right? And it enabled a lot of what happened. I wonder now what your viewpoint is on technology and the business and value of music. Because my 17-year-old won't buy a record now. He's like, Dad, I can get it on Spotify, and I have to listen to a couple commercials. So has technology devalued music?
Not at all, because the difference is, you'll probably buy a $57 ticket to that concert for your son.
Well, he will, because he mows lawns.
Yeah, but he'll buy the $57 ticket versus the $1.29 song, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the way we're projecting out right now, music is bigger than it's ever been before. You know, so Spotify is probably close to 100 million users on the platform.
And we should say you're an investor in Spotify.
Yes, I'm an investor in Spotify. They're probably about 100 million users on the platform. You look at iHeartMedia just in America, they're probably 240 million listeners per week with that. Then you think about Pandora, you think about Apple Music, and the ecosystem's huge. Live Nation just reported their biggest quarter of all time this summer, and I think a lot of it has to do with people having access to all types of music now, and they want the experience of it.
Was there a moment when you said, okay, I've done my thing in music, and I know how to do that, and I'm going to get interested in tech and become a tech investor? Because you have now, how many investments do you have in technology companies?
About 90 investments.
90 investments.
Yeah.
What happened to make you say, I should start doing that?
No, it wasn't part of a grand scheme plan or whatever. I think it was more, at that time, you know, right after we were breaking Gaga, we got introduced to Friends in the Valley, and which turned
Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley, and we got an opportunity to invest in one deal,
mm-hmm.
and then that opportunity turned into another deal. Then we started meeting founders. And I don't think founders ever looked at me as a venture capitalist. It was more of a fellow founder and a peer.
Huh.
Huh. And that could be helpful in moving the needle in their businesses. And, you know, we ended up investing in, you know, Uber. We invested in Spotify, Warby Parker, a bunch of really incredible companies that just have been transformational.
You haven't yet, though, become a venture capitalist, right? You're still doing angel investing on your own, or have you started now this formal venture capital
fund? It's a formal venture capital fund.
Through Adam
But
Factor.
I'm not a venture capitalist.
Explain that.
I won't label myself a venture capitalist.
So that's actually a good question. Label yourself for me. What are you? I started with Impresario.
I'm a founder. You know, I'm a founder. I'm a builder. But you know, I never wanted to put myself even in the box of just talent manager. You know, so the whole thing is, I just try to experience. It's about experiences for me.
You've said actually the biggest danger in business is the box.
The box.
Yeah.
People get stuck in a box. You know, that's what, you know, for all the negative things that people say about millennials, the one thing I love, you know, and kind of even going back to like my parents' generation, and that, like, you know, my grandfather worked at Campbell's Soup Company for, you know, 35 years. My mom worked at Children's Hospital for 30 years. And then, you know, a lot of employers kind of have this retention problem with millennials because they say they jump, you know, job to job or whatever. But I do think there's something in these multiple experiences and not just kind of being locked into this is who you are and this is what you are.
I want to talk about you as a manager for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You've said staff meetings are pretty much a waste of time.
For the most part.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Raise your hand. Anybody? Yeah? All right. What is it you say? Stay small to go global. There's only like 25 or 30 people working at Adam Factory.
Yes.
How are you going to conquer the world if you've only got 30 people working for you?
So to give you an example, and this is what, you know, what technology has been able to do, you know, for an artist like Meghan Trainor, right?
Mm-hmm.
This would have taken... To become a global superstar would have taken 4 or 5 years, you know, prior to the internet, right? And we used to be able to control the pace. You know, we're going to start in New York.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play nightclubs in New York. Then we're going to take it down to Philadelphia, right. Maybe hit Delaware and
right.
Baltimore.
Right.
And strategy used to be mapped out, you know, in that sort of way, right? We put out a song now and literally... If I put out a song literally while we were on the stage, it's in every country all over the world. So you're global within seconds. So so size doesn't matter at that point. And it's about having partners to help support the infrastructure. But for the most part, once you turn it on, you're global now.
When young people come up to pitch you, whether they're entrepreneurs or musicians, how many of them do you reject? How many of them do you say, yeah, no, it's not me, man?
It takes me a while to get to rejection. So it's not a knee-jerk reaction to rejection. So in all fairness, like, I like to hear people out and, like, see if there's something there. By the way, when I first got pitched on Uber, I thought it was the dumbest idea ever.
Wow.
I'm like, I get on the phone with Travis, and I'm like...
Travis Kalanick, the CEO of the family.
You're going to buy all of these black cars? Like, where's the model here? You know, look at the CapEx. And, you know, he's like, no, you idiot.
Listen to you, CapEx.
This is a logistics platform.
Wow.
And, you know, once he explained it, then I got it.
What is your risk tolerance? Better question. How do you assess risk?
It's very, you know, so I'll, to answer the first question, I'm definitely a risk taker for sure. You know, I think just being an entrepreneur naturally is you take risk, right? But I think as you get older and the stakes get higher and things change, your risk profile changes, right? So before, you would have risked it all at you know, 20 years old. You might risk some of it now at 42 and a half. I'll be 43 Saturday.
Congratulations.
But I still say half.
Yeah.
at 42 and a half, you still take the risk, but you won't bet the entire farm. just because you got, you know, as other things that are at stake. And in terms of assessing those risks, you know, I look at it from the artist, from managing artists, you know, because there isn't that much of a capital expense is different, but it's a huge time risk.
Yeah.
So how much time am I going to have to invest in this person's career? And what's the trade-off? And then in terms of investing in companies, it's a bit different because it's the entrepreneur, it's the addressable market, it's the, you know, it's all of these things, the potential exit. So it's all of these other things around it.
Seems to me that you spend most of your time then trying to figure out the future, right? Prognosticating. Is this artist going to be worth my time and energy? Is this company going to be worth my $1 million, whatever it is?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say I spend most of my time looking at the future. It's having an understanding of, I think you have to have a very good understanding of the current marketplace. You know, so
not the future marketplace.
Not the future marketplace, but the current marketplace. You know, and where I'll know musically for the, and you know, I can't say 100% of the time, but with a high percentage, you have an idea whether a product's really gonna work, or whether an act really is gonna work. And you know, you don't get it right all the time, but you know, our job is to get it right most of the time.
You have said that music sells everything but music, and that's why you sort of got into technology. Explain that a little bit.
You know, it's, so I'll uncouple the two. So that's not the reason why I got into technology.
Okay.
So I think that it was a separate statement that I made, where music sells everything but music. You know, when you turn on television commercials, you know, it's going to be
jingle.
Music. It's
right.
Going to be music in the background. You're going to have artists endorsing products. You got all of these things. And going through the devaluation of the actual, let's call it, music file, you know, we weren't, as an industry, we weren't able to capture the value there.
Well,
right?
That's what I was saying earlier, right?
No,
technology
has
devalued music.
It's devaluing the
file. Individual
file. You know,
right.
But music as a whole
right.
is, you know, so it's kind of separating the
yep.
different buckets, right? But music as a whole industry is growing exponentially. It's, you know, it's going to be, but in terms of the actual music file, when you look at the actual value there, to me, the Beatles catalog should be worth more than Spotify, right?
Yeah.
and Spotify is worth more than the entire company, let alone just that single catalog. You know, so I think the industry's done a very poor job in terms of value capture.
Are we then, and I get that this is a tricky thing to ask a tech investor, are we having a tech bubble now?
I'd say it's very frothy on the back end, right?
What are you, Ben Bernanke? Frothy?
No, because I think we got to be careful. Because I think when you say bubble, and this is the reason why it's a polarizing topic.
Yeah.
When you say bubble, I think people automatically revert to 1999
yeah.
when the
yeah.
world crashed. It's definitely not going to be that.
Okay.
Definitely not going to be that. I think we were at a totally different state. There weren't no smartphones. You didn't have the globalization. Companies didn't have revenue streams. You had, you know, a million companies going public after, you know, 8 weeks, you know, eight-week
right.
startup going public. So I think it was a different environment, right? But with that being said, we have a lot of companies that are overvalued right now. Just, you know, somebody said it perfectly last week, I think a few weeks ago, Bill Gurley, when he referred to them as subprime unicorns, right?
Yeah.
I think that part I agree with. You know, it's a lot. There are a lot of companies that shouldn't be worth $1 billion that are worth $1 billion. And I think it's the capital markets, both the private capital markets and the public capital markets, right? But I think there's still a lot of value in early stage, but the late stage is where we're seeing a lot of the issues.
Is there too much money out there chasing this?
Way too much. So when I say problems in the capital
yeah.
market, you know, when everybody I know has a fund, you know, and I probably have 15, 20 buddies with, you know, $200 million plus wow. funds. Wow. You know, you got a few of them with a billion plus funds, and then you got a million angel investors and a bunch in between, and then you have some of the large, since these companies are taking forever to go to IPO, yep. you got a lot of the large players that just basically they want to get in on the action, so they're willing to, you know, to write the larger checks. So I just think, where I don't think the world's going to fall apart, but I do think we're going to see a real correction, and a much-needed correction, by the way.
Last one, and then I got to get you guys out of here. When was the last time you failed?
I fail all the time. Yeah, all like it's pretty regular. no, you know what?
We should all fail like you.
No, you know what? I think a lot of times, you know, your rights become louder than your wrongs, and you're able to bury your dead very quietly. But the reality is, I take a lot of chances. We invest in companies that fail. You know, for every Uber, you know, you get five things in your portfolio that doesn't work. You know, for every Meghan Trainor and Lady Gaga and John Legend, you got artists that don't become quite so successful or whatever. And what I try to do, I try to take those things as sometimes you just don't get the timing right. Sometimes you made a bad decision. Sometimes, you know, somebody screwed it up. So it's like, you know, just being able to assess it and not getting too high with the highs, not getting too low with the lows. You know, sometimes you get disappointed and you get knocked out of you. But I think it's important that you visit that place, because you're going to keep failing if you don't take those failures seriously. So I think you absolutely visit that place, but you can't choose to live there.
Troy Carter, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go. Troy Carter, the founder and CEO of Atom Factory. Thanks so much for listening to Corner Office. We are back, of course, next month with another installment.